listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
What great timing to host tonight's discussion in the same week as we celebrate the achievements of Martin Luther King. Where are we now? How do we address, quote, that most complicated of American words, another four-letter word, race, as posited by author Jeff Chang? In his stunning new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, Chang focuses on the visual culture shaping the past 50 years of American politics, art, and race relations, literally asking, how do we see ourselves? He explores this question through a rich narrative that runs the gamut from Maury Turner, the first nationally syndicated African-American cartoonist, to the Obama Joker, the dreamers, the occupiers, and the images that have defined these moments and movements. Filmmaker Justin Simien's brilliant feature, Dear White People, which won the Special Jury Award for Breakthrough Talent at Sundance last year, doesn't only speak to the complexities of identity through its satirical look at the complicated lives of college students in Obama's America, but also proves there is a thirst for smart, provocative stories about race. This project was partially funded by fans before it was even made. On a daily basis, we see how social media, now its own character in this live dialogue on race, has fueled student activism around the country. And so we are left to ask, where do art and action intersect for true change? To take us into a deeper discussion tonight, we welcome Jeff Chang, author of the award-winning Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. His newest book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, is a dense and generous masterwork, a must-read for anyone looking to understand our shared American culture. Jeff is visiting us from Stanford University, where he is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts. In conversation with Jeff is Justin Simien, who, in addition to being a filmmaker and featured in Variety magazine as one of 10 directors to watch, he is also author of the fun and provocative book, Dear White People, A Guide to Interracial Harmony in Post-Racial America. And moderating tonight's conversation is Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, journalist and author who's been writing about Black issues since 1992. She's been a staff writer for the LA Weekly and an opinion columnist for the LA Times. Her collection of essays and reportage, Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line, Dispatches from a Black Journalista, is available online, and her second book about the cultural legacy of Barack Obama is due out later this year. So let's get to it. Please give our guests a warm welcome to the Aloud stage.
Thank you, Maureen. Well, we've been introduced, so I don't have to do that. So, how was your King Day, Martin Luther King Day, guys?
It was good. Went on a hike.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I did not Instagram pictures of it. Someone seen my movie.
And Jeff?
I was traveling, and I was reading Taylor Branch on Selma, because I was able to see Ava DuVernay's movie this past weekend. It was a packed house.
Selma.
This amazing vibe. Yeah, just yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Powerful. So.
Seems like a confluence of things, Selma and other projects.
Absolutely.
Going on. Well, here we are having another conversation about race, and I say that with some fatigue. we're going to get to all of that, but let's just start out with that whole, just the word race. because we were talking about this before the this evening. But so my first question to you guys is, so what do we mean by race these days? It's become to me kind of a catch-all for everything from racism, which is something specific, to diversity, which is kind of an offshoot of race and racism, to even Islamophobia. We call that racism. Mm-hmm. It has to do with race. Yeah. So, you know, and I'll just say this is my view. It used to be race used to be kind of shorthand for the Negro problem, mm-hmm. right? Because it was something we had to solve. It was something we had to contend with. It was something that had to be solved, you know, solved or resolved somehow. So I think that's still true, but the conversation around it has really changed. And the politics of talking about it has changed. So just what are we talking about now when we talk about race? We're talking about it now because of Ferguson. We're going to get to that later. But, you know, I know what I'm talking about, but is there sort of a consensus about race?
Ooh.
That's a big one, man.
Threw us in the deep end of the pool.
Right?
You can handle it.
Yeah, swimming furiously now.
Sure.
Jeff, I think you gotta take this one, man.
Wow. Wow. I talk about it in the book. Obviously, it's a social construct. We know that race is not a biological thing.
Right.
We know that race has been something that's brought the nation to the brink of dissolution many times over. Selma, you know, is a perfect depiction of one of those moments.
Right.
And we know that it still divides us today, but we can't even really talk about it, right? That's sort of when you mentioned that having the conversation on race today, it's just fraught to say let's have a conversation about race. I guess one of the things that I was thinking about, or I've been thinking a lot about, is the visuality of race.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book is kind of organized around this theme of, like, how do we see race now? And how
literally,
is that
how do we see it?
How how do we see it?
Right.
So I write that race is sort of, race emerges between appearance and the perception of difference. Mm. And it's not that difference, seeing difference, is a bad thing. Like, we all see difference. It's part of how we're wired. As babies, we're trained to see difference. We learn difference. We're trying to figure out who our mommy is. That's that classic, Are You My Mother, right? That book is sort of a classic of social psychology, right? It's sort of...
Right.
It's we see difference, but it's what we attach to difference, I think, that is what the story of Trayvon Martin is, what the story of Michael Brown is, what the story of Eric Garner is, what the story of Renisha McBride and Akai Gurley and John Crawford and Anastasio Hernandez Rojas as Guanzhong Gao. Like, we could just go on and on and on. That's
right.
The story. And I think that's what we kind of have to get to now. So when I guess I'm asking about, can we have a conversation on race? I'm asking if we can have a conversation that points us towards racial justice.
Oh.
And a consensus around racial justice that we haven't had since 1965.
That's really interesting, because we keep having these conversations, mm-hmm. and I guess I say I have fatigue because conversations are conversations.
It's been a lot of them.
And it's a big leap from conversation to justice, what you're talking about. But how do images fit in there? Like, we've gotten the images down pretty well. I'm pretty good. I mean, we're going to talk about images that, you know, that are out there. That seems to be integrated, the images. But like you said, there's a gap between images and reality. But when we talk about race, do you still think we're talking about the Negro problem for the most part?
Yeah, I mean, Black Lives Matter, right? The fact that and the thing that folks who are questioning that have to kind of understand is, it's not saying that Black lives matter than other people's lives, right? It's saying all lives matter, but the tragedy is in the redundancy, right? All lives matter, but the tragedy is in the redundancy that we have to reaffirm that Black lives matter at this point in history.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the hashtag was created for.
Yeah.
Because it was created by three African-American women right? One of whom is an immigration activist, two of whom are very deeply involved in queer politics. Mm-hmm. And so it's also about complicating what Black lives look like as well. And this is what, you know, Alicia and Patrice and Opal have been saying all along. So so it's not about, like, yeah, it's about reaffirming everyone's humanity, and especially saying at this particular point in town, let's focus on this particular question. And it gets back to what I think the civil rights movement was about. And I'm talking too much. I wanted to shut up already, but
I'll shut you up. Go on,
please. But it gets back to what the civil rights movement was about, which is that freedom, the freedom movement that comes from organized African-American struggle, mm-hmm. Is a freedom struggle for everyone.
Right.
And I think that is what people are trying to emphasize at this particular point in history.
Great. And you made me think of, speaking of the civil rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement reminds me very much of that iconic image in 1968, the year King was killed, mm-hmm. the Black sanitation workers with their signs, "I am a man." Mm. They were trying to get fair, you know, fair wages, etc. And that declaration, "I am a man," is to me echo. I mean, Black Lives Matter is kind of the same. It echoes that.
Yeah.
So it makes me think about how far we have not come.
Yeah.
And also,
in many ways, but yeah, go ahead, Justin.
And also, just to talk about the Black, I mean, the thing that I was sort of taken aback by, but it's just, I think, speaks to where we are now, too, is that race is, I think it's something that, in a very real way, people of color have to deal with every day. But I think it also is, like you said, it's a social contract that we've all sort of inherited. And I feel a sense of envy.
Envy?
From people. The idea of...
People envy you?
I'll put it this way. The idea of whiteness, mm-hmm. I think, is something that's gained a lot of popularity. The idea that, like, you know, this sense that, you know, we're a part of it too. The fact that Black Lives Mattered was appropriated into All Lives Mattered. Mm-hmm. The fact that anyone would take offense to that hashtag, given the way the place of the nation is, I think that's an interesting thing to talk about. There seemed to be a victim envy kind of going on.
Right? I matter too. I am.
Yeah, it was people took it as some sort of assault on their matterness.
So we have white people saying I am somebody,
or just that that their race, you know, their racial identity. You know, carries weight with it as well.
And, you know,
and in some ways, like, that's being ignored. I think it's interesting. It's sort of, even the idea of sort of, you know, being a minority is in some ways been appropriated.
Everybody's.
Yeah, everybody wants to, I think, sort of be a part of that too.
Well, you know, this is part of the thing that I find so interesting and I find frustrating is that I think that there's this reluctance to just focus on Black people and say, you know, you have a particular problem, we need to pay attention. People are very resistant to that. Mm. And they'll say, no, well, let's put everybody in the mix as a way of sort of erasing the problems in particular, say, to Black people.
Right.
Everyone has particular problems. You know, immigrants have particular problems. Women have particular problems. We seem very reluctant to focus on problems of Black people because the kinds of, it disturbs the American story that
yes.
we like so much. At the bottom. So we want to move on and just make it a bigger question, bigger issue.
It disturbs the ideal that we want to hold.
It disturbs the ideal, whether it's Ferguson or Trayvon Martin, or we can go down the list. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really, the inclusion sounds good, the inclusion of everyone. Right. But it also, in a way, softens the difference that can
right.
be important.
Right.
Right.
And so, you know, King Day, and I'm trying to prep for giving a talk around this. And
uh-huh.
one of the things that Vincent Harding, who was one of the co-writers of the March on Washington speech, the "I Have a Dream," the famous "I Have a Dream" speeches, mm-hmm. is that he says that the complexity of the speech has been reduced to what's the easiest thing that we can actually say that it's all about, right? So
that's marketing.
So it's marketing, right? Which
we're gonna get to that too. We're gonna get to marketing, right?
But it's about one sentence, you know. I want my children to be judged not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character, right? And entire national politics shift around this particular phrase, where, you know, he's talking about, like, he has a quote where he says, "What, you know, people ask me, when are you going to be happy?" And the first thing he says is, "When African Americans," he didn't say, "when Negroes don't have to be concerned about being the victims of horrible police brutality." That was the first thing that he said.
We don't hear that on
We don't hear that on King Day too much.
And everybody claims King. Conservatives claim him.
Yeah.
You know, he's been just reappropriated and reappropriated.
But I think the thing that he got right too, and what is also not kind of brought out during King Day, was to realize that all of these struggles are interconnected. So that if you look at, for instance, we could talk about this forever and ever. I could talk about this forever and ever. If you look at the way that racism plays out, at different points, there's different fronts and different targets. So after 9/11, we see, I was in Brooklyn at the time, right? And I was living in Brooklyn. I was reporting in Brooklyn. I wanted to know how the kids are feeling. Went out to the park, talked to the kids. All the kids were saying, you know, they're not looking for us anymore. They're looking for the towel heads.
Wow.
And
the black kids said
the black kids are saying this. And so they felt a sense of relief. And literally within 2 years, the entire Arab American, Pakistani American communities over there by Borum Hill and that kind of thing had been completely wiped out. A lot of folks had been deported. They just disappeared by this enforcement of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. And at the same time that this is happening, they're testing all kinds of military weapons at the border, mm-hmm. right? So when we see in Ferguson this crazy response, right, in which
the militaristic response
where the military folks are saying, oh, this is overkill, right? All of that stuff is the effect of racism against immigrants, racism against Arabs, South Asians, Muslim Americans, anybody who looks or folks think of as Muslim American.
But we've had
they're all interrelated.
We've had a lot of practice at it, oppressing black people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
Yes. Before we get to the next question, Russell, can we show the trailer?
Is that a laugh line?
We've had a lot of practice.
This is dear white people, the trailer for the movie. How many of you have actually seen the movie? Oh, I recommend it. Yeah. So we're going to take a look.
Yes, please see it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, you know, everybody's laughing. I watched the whole movie. I didn't laugh once. No, I really...
You got mad.
No, I liked the movie, but I thought, this is real. This is real.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me, which kind of points to how surreal... racial experience is
sure.
You know, we've experienced those things in real life.
I mean, that's kind of that's how you know when it comes to a satire that you got something right. Is that unfortunately the culture in some ways catches up to, you know, the satire. You look at something like a movie like Network or Bamboozled, and in every way we are living the reality of those.
Yeah, we are bamboozled, and Network has come true.
Yeah.
Mm. So let's talk about multiculturalism. You know, we. You know, I started reporting in the 90s, and, you know, we now are used to words like diversity, multiculturalism, and we sort of equate that with race. Mm-hmm. And they're not the same things. But anyway, I just wanted to throw this out to both of you. So in different ways, your movie, Dear White People, and sure. Jeff, your book, Who We Be, I also want to call it Who We See. Because it's about images. Mm-hmm. They both critique multiculturalism as this great idea.
I'm going to change the title for the paperback.
Give me credit. So, Dear White People and also your work, Jeff, they both critique multiculturalism as this great idea that in practice still keeps people of color at the margins, trying to assert their right to be taken seriously. As we saw in Justin's trailer, Sam, the protagonist in your movie, is a campus activist fighting a new rule at the college that ends the black-only dorm assignments in the name of fairness. We call that fairness. You know, we're all included. But she, as she said in the trailer, she's like, you know, we got to bring black back. We are losing our space. And I'm thinking, yeah, It's not funny. It's not funny. And then, Jeff, in your book, and I recommend Jeff's book. It's really wonderful. The artists, all the artists' movements you describe in your book in the 60s and later, you know, the encouraging, there's all these movements for these artists, visual artists, to assert themselves, claim their space, you know, advance their point of view, their view of the world. They're encouraging, but they're kind of episodic. They don't last, right? And it's kind of like you have to keep starting the fight over and over and over to get to the center. Mm-hmm. So I guess in fact, at one point you say that it fails. Multiculturalism as a movement fails. Mm-hmm. So what happened, and how do you see that fight now? Where are we with this multiculturalism, whatever it is? Mm.
There's like a really interesting scene. Well, all through the movie, you're kind of emphasizing questions of appropriation, right? Like how whites are actually, you know, seeing hip hop and adopting that and wanting
That's
to have
going
license
on for a long time.
Of course, yeah. But wanting to have license to be able to you know, enact their craziest, deepest ratio, right?
Deep-rooted
fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it for me was that I've often been a black face in a white space most of my life.
And yeah, me too.
And navigating, you know, between mostly, I'd say, you know, white-dominated spaces, whether that's a college or, you know, an office space. And one of the things that I felt uniquely oppressed by and didn't even, and almost had a paranoia about feeling that way was colorblindness. You know, this idea that, like, we are colorblind, that we don't see race. In a way, it made me feel as if that's just another way of saying that you're blind to the fact that as a person of color, I'm having a different experience than you. And I'm not allowed to sort of bring up the things that I see and the things that I'm feeling because you are colorblind and you personally are beyond racism. But, you know, that means that you're completely blind to the ways in which, you know, you may have made me feel when the minute I got in your car, you know, switched it to, you know, 50 Cent or whatever. And, you know, which, you know, I enjoy 50 Cent, but I'm just saying, this idea of microaggressions, which wasn't really a word when I first started writing the film, but, you know, I quickly appropriated once I saw that people had given it a word, given it a phrase, is a way to just describe the fact that, you know, it may not be lynch mob style racism, but I feel in some way I'm being kept from a part of the culture, but it's sort of underneath these layers of, you know, well, this is a post-racial society and I'm personally not racist, so therefore, you know, your feelings aren't valid. Right. And I wanted the world of the film to sort of take place in that version of, you know, really this school is a microcosm of the American experience. I wanted it to take place in that version of America where, you know, there's plenty of black people on the, you know, the brochure of the school, but you can't really find them when you get there.
Right.
And they're not allowed to sort of live in the same dorm if they want to, you know.
Once again, marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But you bring up a really important point. I also, you know, clench when I hear colorblindness. It's just the same. It's someone else dictating that to me.
Sure.
I'm not interested in being colorblind, but other people are, so I have to abide by that.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanna really turn off people at a cocktail party, start talking about racial inequality to somebody white.
And I know.
You can't talk about that because I don't allow it.
Yeah.
And so who do I talk about it to? I'll talk about it to you, but you and I already know. And
right.
So this whole there are two worlds.
To the choir.
Right. So
as a person of color, what do you do to survive? What do you do to sort of
shopping?
Get up in the ranks and in a lot of ways my movie deals with, you know, these four characters who are surviving in this place in four very different ways.
Sure.
You know, you have Sam who sort of makes a point to sort of call this stuff out to the point where it actually overtakes the rest, you know, most her life, this identity as, you know, this provocateur sort of kind of overtakes the other things.
You become a professional black person.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, but in a way you have to.
Absolutely.
So that's why I wasn't laughing. I was like, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
that's me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry that you just got to enjoy it, but.
Why am I here? I'm going
home.
But, no, but it takes up a lot. You're right. It takes up a lot of her energy. And then the kind of the subtle story underneath that story is, who am I under that?
Yeah, I mean, it's like
that part of me is real, but what about the other parts of me that
when you have to navigate the world based on other people's assumptions of you that you inherit, that you just inherited just by being born the way you are.
Right.
You don't get to ask the question of who am I and what am I about and what matters in my life. You don't get to ask that question as soon as other people.
Right.
Who don't have to answer, who don't have to walk through the world wading through other people's assumptions of them.
That's right. And this reminds me I was thinking of the show Girls. How many of you have seen HBO's mm-hmm. Girls? I really liked it, but in spite of everything, I like the show.
I'm a fan.
I'm astounded that these group of white girls who can all they do is talk about themselves.
Yeah. I mean, there's
and that's weird. All they think about. And I wish I could try to imagine a black show like that. I couldn't imagine it because there's too much. There are other things in the world that people have to deal with first. We have to deal with first before we can even talk about me.
Right.
Ad nauseum. I'm not sure I would be. Like to do that anyway, but it's just fascinating just how that works. How
I love the show. I think it's odd that there's no black people in Brooklyn in the show, but I
right.
But I do like it.
You remember it was like the after the first season there was that critique mm-hmm. of Lena Dunham, and so she brought on Donald Glover to play her boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Like was it one or two? It wasn't very long.
It was half an episode.
Yeah.
It was like that.
It was like,
This is what I thought was really interesting, and this is what I thought like is so what she really got right actually mm-hmm. about this aborted or sort of hamstrung or stalemated or stalled, whatever, race conversation
mm-hmm.
is like she's trying to break up with dude, mm-hmm. right? They're sitting on the couch together.
I remember that.
And he's like trying to understand where she's coming from, and she ends up turning the whole conversation back. Mm-hmm. To be about her,
yeah,
which is classic girls, right? But it's
yeah.
it's sort of like we're gonna talk about race, but we're gonna talk about how I feel about race,
yeah, how and right. I, me feel right, that you're bringing this conversation
right.
up,
right?
Right.
Yeah. The question though, really, is that meant to make her look foolish, or is that how things really are? I mean, I thought she looked foolish, but I think
she was being honest, which is what
I think
about the show. She's being honest. I mean, it may not be a flattering picture of herself
right.
and what it means to be a white girl in your 20s, but I thought she was being honest.
I think the cluelessness is part of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Supposed to understand they're clueless.
I think what you were saying is right. If a person of color brings up race to a white person, and this is not to stereotype all of the white race either, but mm-hmm. Oftentimes I find that the response happens to be about defending themselves. Whereas, I wouldn't even bring it up to you if I thought, that you weren't able to handle that topic. If you yourself was racist, I wouldn't bring up something like that. So right. No need to, assuage my, sort of fears about you. I'm good. We're good. We're at the same party. We're, enjoying the same wines and the same cheeses. Like,
right.
I'm good.
Right.
It's not about you.
Right. But it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Jeff, real quick about, can you explain multiculturalism to us?
Can I explain multiculturalism?
why isn't it working?
Yeah, you always
why isn't it working?
Why do people so hate Obama?
I'm the dictionary dude tonight. Okay, so.
I like it.
Well, here's what I was interested in. Oh, really? Wow. I see also the clock
just kidding.
Here,
I'm just kidding.
So what I was interested in was kind of resuscitating the notion of multiculturalism, because it didn't begin as this sort of milquetoast, kumbaya.
No, it didn't.
It's
one thing I learned in
college brochure kind of idea,
no,
right?
No,
it started off as this sort of radical avant-garde kind of counterculture.
In the 60s.
Idea, yeah. Coming out of the 60s into the 70s, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, but in a lot of ways, the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area is kind of what pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming out of these sorts of arts movements that are transgressive and breaking through, but not necessarily bringing a challenge to the narrative of the U.S. in of itself. So there's all kinds of formal challenges that are happening. There's all kinds of sort of experimentation that's kind of happening. Multiculturalism becomes kind of a challenge to the way that the U.S. sees itself. Because at this time, like, people of color are basically invisible, right? So...
You mean in society or as artists?
In society, as artists, images, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what these artists and writers kind of on the fringe here are kind of saying is, well, look, if you really told the true story of the U.S., then you would include all of these stories that aren't being told, mm-hmm. our stories. And in that regard, it was a radical idea.
Even the notion of America.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And the notion is that it's a multiculture. And that was a crazy idea at the time because everybody thought that American culture could only be one thing. You had to be WASP. And that was an American culture. And if you were not going to assimilate to that, then you were never going to be become part of, become part of society. So what they were trying to do was to really fragment that kind of a narrative. And I think what happens over time is those stories begin to get told through a lot of struggle, through a lot of protest, through a lot of visionary artists and sort of folks who are working to create this alternative culture industry. And you have then this demographic surge that happens in the 80s and the 90s. So all of the stuff that comes out of the civil rights movement, all the legislative victories that are about bringing people of color into the mainstream of U.S. life, you start seeing that in the 80s and the 90s in the bodies of all of these young people who are showing up in schools and on campuses, particularly here in California. And the students aren't being silent. They're saying, we need to demand that changes happen on this campus so that it's not cool to call me a chink anymore. We're going to change the codes of conduct, the sort of parameters of civility here, right? Campus climate, they called it, right? We're going to diversify the curriculum. We're going to diversify the kinds of staff folks. We're going to have folks understand what it means to teach all this stuff. We're going to teach these histories and knowledges.
That started in the 60s, right?
That started in the 60s, but what you really have is the institutionalization of it during the 80s and the 90s. And this is when the backlash happens. Right. This is when the culture wars begin.
Yes.
And the LA riots play a huge role in this. Mm-hmm. Right. Because there's sort of this gathering storm.
The first one or the second one?
92. Second.
Okay.
Right. LA 2.
LA 2.
So.
Writing.
What's that?
Nothing.
Oh.
came with a sequel. Doesn't matter.
Die harder.
Oh no.
Whew.
Oh boy.
It's just a metaphor.
Dark.
Okay.
Just kidding.
First sequel that came to mind. Anyway. So it worked. I mean, that was a good thing. But then there was backlash.
The backlash coheres really in the thank you for getting me back on track because I was sort of getting lost there. But
LA 2,
right. So you're getting me off track again. So the backlash begins to cohere, right? And what we see is sort of this buildup from Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, to the formation of the National Association of Scholars to combat political correctness on campus.
The anti-political correctness.
Right.
Into
92, where Pat Buchanan gets up at the 1992 Republican Convention, tells this story about these elderly white people in Los Angeles who are about to be besieged by these crazy looters who, of course, like, he didn't have to say it, but he's conjuring a picture of brown and black looters coming to destroy this, you know, elderly home. And he says, you know, this is where we draw the line, right? And he declares the culture wars at that particular point.
I remember that.
And that, I think, is when you start to see things changing. Because as soon as the backlash coheres in that way, at the same time, we see the marketplace going, oh, wait a minute. We still need to figure out how to get all those folks who are out there in the streets
to buy stuff. Yes.
And we need to figure out how to go global because actually if we look at the world, it's mostly young, it's mostly urban, and it's mostly not white, right? And so multiculturalism and hip hop become these perfect ways for these brands to remake themselves during the 1990s. And I think that this is the moment at which we start seeing multiculturalism crossover, lose its radicality, and become kind of this like meaningless, empty cliche. Like when we get to 2000 and George W. Bush is appointing Alberto Gonzalez and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, you see the Republicans saying, literally, this is how we do business now, right? There's a book that comes out that's called We Are All Multiculturalists Now. And so that's That's sort of, I think, the point at which you go, oh, okay, well, on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, there's a kind of a corporate takeover of multiculturalism. And there's also political expediency to the whole thing. But in terms of actually quality, It's not really happening.
It's okay. It's tokenism, right?
Tokenism. Like, yeah, that's another way
talking about in your book. Yeah.
It's the Power Rangers. Yeah.
It's the Power Rangers.
It is. You get the black guy, the black kid, Black Ranger.
And yet, somehow, I think this perfectly leads into the next thing, but I think we somehow start believing that. I have a friend who called this virtual integration. The images are all integrated. It's all balanced. The commercials, you know, there's people of all colors. And you say, yeah, that's how things are. Mm-hmm. Things are better because that commercial there, you know, there's an interracial couple. Whatever it is you see, you start saying, that's progress.
Right.
And we get kind of confused about that.
Yeah.
And you have black people telling you, no, actually, there's a lot.
Yeah, I don't know.
People are like, what are you talking about? I just saw a commercial.
right.
You notice how I just happened, when I was looking at the trailer, I just couldn't, you know, I'm thinking he looks like Barack Obama, you know.
Yeah.
Starting, you know, so people, it infiltrates people's minds and they start to buy the product of multiculturalism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Forget about the reality. Okay, so can we have the slides, please? This leads to my question about advertising.
Okay.
For those of you old enough to remember, Benetton, remember Benetton? This Jeff's book is this is a very interesting history of how, you know, we just talked about how multiculturalism became a global ad campaign because, you know, basically we're trying to figure out how to sell things to people. Now Benetton, let me just ask a question, then we'll get to Benetton. Benetton was actually one of the most radical. Had something else was trying to do besides sell you sweaters, but so advertising and marketing, which is pretty much what America's gift to the world, or whatever you want to call it, gives us the most powerful and persuasive images when it comes to images that influence how we think about race. Mm-hmm. I really think people really buy what they see. So we take those images to be reflections of reality or the projections of what we like to believe is real. It's like we like to believe everybody's all together. It kind of takes care of all the justice stuff and all the, you know, it's in our pictures, it's in our images. So, Jeff, your book describes these really fascinating campaigns by Coca-Cola in the 60s. For those of you who really want to go way back to I Want to Teach the World to Sing, remember that campaign?
Yeah.
And I've been humming it ever since I read your book.
Sorry.
I really believed in that campaign. I thought
sorry,
it was like...
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. There was that. And also Benetton in the 80s to sell America... So basically, but both were selling this product of diversity, right? And Justin, your film, Dear White People, shows really powerfully how the modern urban, I hate that word, urban, black, which is code language for black, images that are popular in a lot of hip hop has mainstreamed this kind of blackness.
Yeah.
But it's kind of almost like a product, that kind of.
It's absolutely.
It's a product. It's a blackness. To the point where whites and non-blacks feel okay, like doing what you saw in the clip, which is this, I call it the Compton cookout.
Right.
Which is what we had here, actually, in a campus in San Diego. Yep. Just people feeling free to literally put on blackface, be the biggest, baddest Negro. You know, that's like, it's almost like wearing a costume.
Yeah.
And there's no...
Because it's a product, like anything.
It's a product.
You can buy it and wear it. And
right. But we don't attach it to history. We don't attach it to anything. Actually, sort of this postmodern view of race. So... let's take a look at these slides real quick. So this is Benetton, and Jeff, you might want to talk us through.
So so the tagline is "All the colors of the world."
All the colors of the world.
Eventually, Benetton like changed their actual brand name to United Colors of Benetton.
Yes, I
and
remember.
And this is the interesting thing about it is I kind of contrasted this with the literature that was arising at that particular moment in the business literature, and they were talking about globalization at the time. And the idea is, literally, you get all of the diverse people of the world and you clothe them in the same Cosby sweaters. That was
scary.
Well, so this is diversity de-radicalized, right? This is like diversity kind of literally taken apart from the beginning.
Yeah. Ooh, now, this is one of Benetton's, you might remember their ad campaign. It was the people behind it were these fairly radical artists. And what they started to do was challenge people's perceptions of race. Many of these ads are pretty controversial. I don't remember if you remember these. So they kind of got away from just putting everybody in the same Cosby sweater to kind of challenging, playing with or putting in your face.
Right.
You can see here this image of these two, you know, the black man and coal miners.
Coal miners, absolutely.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. He's a coal miner.
Right. I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he is.
That blonde, coal miners have blonde bobs now.
Yes. Well, many of these images, it's funny, some of them were not well received in this country, particularly by black people who said, what is Benetton doing?
Right.
You can't just put these images out there and expect them to not, you know. But I think that was the intention of some of these pictures. Mm-hmm. I remember this one pretty well. And again, I think the NAACP, some other black groups, objected to what they saw as that, quote, looks like a Buckwheat and Shirley Temple.
Shirley Temple and Buckwheat.
Right.
Right.
And of course, you know, the devil horns don't help. On the
not at all.
Yeah. But again.
The fear in her eyes.
Yeah. Right.
So this is about.
I got to do this.
This is about selling clothing, but also we want to talk about what were these ads trying to do? What were they trying to educate us about?
So, you know, Oliviero Toscani, who was the creator of these ads, he sort of had this idea that he would offer contrasts, you know, like if you have color, then you have contrasts, right? It's the other. On those old TVs is the other button. So for this, he was trying to basically have, you know, whites in with, you know, coal on their face, black face in some ways, and to contrast also kids' skin tones as well. And he kind of offered a formal explanation for it. Like he's playing with color, he's playing with contrast and that kind of thing. And kind of skirted the whole history, of course, of the fact that American national popular culture in the 19th century starts with blackface minstrelsy.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so our entire popular culture is based in that. And so in that respect, like your
and it's
movie
still
is
baked in and
yeah.
still there and
it's still there.
Off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
still
Absolutely
and that's
still there.
Iggy Azalea. So we could talk about Iggy Azalea, but I don't want to.
That's a whole other way
we're
going.
That's another thing.
No, we
okay.
don't want to go there, actually.
We don't? Okay.
It just slipped out. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
We should go to the next slide.
Coal
okay,
miner.
Sorry. Ah,
he's
now this
coal
is
coal miner.
This is going back. This is 1960, whatever that, the Coca-Cola, remember? I want, how does that, the people on the hill.
Well,
I'd like. And by the way,
harmony.
I was like 10 years old, and I really thought this was a real version of America. I really did.
Yeah.
I didn't. I was too young to know any better. But I thought this was sort of the post 60s new world. You know, this is a new reality.
Yeah.
I felt very much like this. You know, I felt encouraged by this.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about the history of this campaign? Just a little bit, because we're running. A little short
yeah,
of time,
sure.
but this is fascinating to me.
There's a great story behind it. I don't want to get into the whole thing because it's just, there's so many amazing things to it. But
right,
this is happening right at the moment where we're deep in the Vietnam War.
Yes.
There's all kinds of racial tension. This is 1972.
A lot of pessimism. You
a
say.
Lot of pessimism. And so so the McCarran Erickson, the advertising firm that's working with Coke is like, we're going to rebrand you at this particular point and try to make it seem like Coke is the thing that brings everybody together.
Right. Coke brings everybody together.
So again, like, the again, sort of, right.
Is that funny?
Whoops.
Okay.
Depends what kind of Coke,
yeah.
too. But
yeah.
the
oh, that Coke. Okay.
The whole,
uh-huh.
That's later in the 70s, maybe.
Yeah.
So so I think, you know, the important point about this is that at different points, and you saw Coca-Cola doing this again, last year with the Super Bowl, I don't know if people saw the America the Beautiful ad in the Super Bowl. They had these gorgeous images of all these different people. They're singing, what were they singing? Were they singing America the Beautiful? Yeah, in different languages.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Including Arab and Spanish. And there's this huge protest that occurs the next day. Like, how can you, this is sacrilegious. This is like, you know, this is our national anthem. It wasn't the national anthem, of course. It's not the national anthem. That's not our national anthem, folks.
America the Beautiful? No.
Right.
No,
yeah.
It's not.
It's not, right?
No.
And so the point is that now Coca-Cola can position themselves as being against Islamophobia, against racism, against these crazy trolls that they're going to get hit on by the internet. So they can take the high road and position themselves on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm. They were trying to do this with this ad. This was pretty radical for the time, right?
Right.
This you know, people on a hill all coming together,
right.
drinking Coke.
But my point is, at the end of the day, if we're going to depend on the marketplace to lead us to King's Promised Land.
Racial justice.
Right,
just
racial
don't
justice.
Finish that sentence.
Yeah. Okay.
If we just all buy a McRib.
Yeah.
You know.
And yet...
The black, I can't with the black McDonald's commercials. That's the one thing.
Right.
You know, everybody in the McDonald's is black and eating McRibs. And
right.
And they're loving it. They're loving
right.
it.
They are loving
right.
it.
Yes.
That's right.
But, you know, this reminds me, years ago, Walmart, which is, you know, the biggest retailer in the world, was trying to open a super center in the Crenshaw area. And they ran these commercials that actually had pictures of, this is the completion of King's dream. Walmart.
Stop it.
Wow.
because of the jobs, they uh-huh. had pictures of black
That's
people.
The completion?
Yes.
Okay.
And they had pictures right. of black people looking heavenward like
oh,
this.
Oh, boy.
The dream was Walmart. And I thought, I had to hit myself like,
oh, jeez.
So, but this I believed in when I was 10. Yeah. I believed in it.
Well, it just makes me think that, you know, the Black Lives Matter campaign is now going after Walmart because of the shooting and murder of John Crawford in Walmart.
Yes.
So,
well, there's other reasons.
That's why I'm facepalming.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I got a question. Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
For Jeff. Multicultural. So does it fail because it is too on the surface, or is it just fundamentally flawed, this idea?
I don't think that the idea of radical diversity has lost any kind of its...
And radical, I'm sorry, by radical, you mean everybody really is at the center, or everybody, there's a,
I mean,
there's we're a real equality.
We're real equality,
yeah.
That we're surfacing these stories that are not told. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Black Lives Matter, talking about queer lives, black queer lives, talking about black immigrant lives, you know, talking about the margins of the margins, the mm-hmm. subaltern...
Bringing things from the margins into
yeah,
the center.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I don't think that notion of radical diversity has lost any of its importance, mm-hmm. and I think it still should guide what we're talking about when we're moving towards racial justice. But what I think we see now is this sort of like banal corporate and state multiculturalism,
superficial, completely on the surface,
completely on the surface, and it's about like leaving everything the way it is, but just sort of putting, you know, different faces mm-hmm. To the same old
and having everybody buy the same stuff.
And also sort of presenting a version of America that's all mixed up, but no one has any problems. Like there's
exactly.
Right. There's no center.
There's no story.
There's no center.
The Black Ranger has, you know, never faces racial injustice. You know?
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, been a powerful type of thing. I mean, like, as soon as Obama got elected, you saw this huge backlash, the return of the culture wars, right? Suddenly he's like a Muslim, he's a socialist, he's an illegal alien, right?
He's a joker.
He's like everything that's other. But at the same time, on the liberal side, it's like, oh, we've arrived, right? We've gone to the other side of the mountaintop. And I feel like in a lot of ways, it's really interesting because I work with students and I work with young folks all the time. And, you know, I'm working now with young folks who have never known when there wasn't a black president, when there wasn't hip-hop.
That's amazing to think
right?
about. Right? Yeah.
And so...
There wasn't the internet.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing to me about the last 2-3 years and about, like, your movie arriving when it did, because I know you're working on it for, like, 8 years?
Yeah, some time.
Arriving when it did was that it was exactly what folks were... looking for. It's like folks kind of lost the language to be able to describe what was actually happening.
Well,
they lost the narrative.
And also because we were sort of subtly told by the culture that that story wasn't worth telling.
Right.
Or it was over or something.
It was over, yeah. You know, it's this idea of colorblindness. Well, if they're blind to this experience, why even bring it up, you know?
Yeah, and also we haven't even mentioned the word post-black or post-racial, which I kind of change.
Sure.
Right.
But that idea is not that. That sounds apocalyptic. Like there's no more black people anywhere. They're gone. they've been disappeared. They've raptured away or something. But that's also part of that color blindness. You no longer. You're done.
We're done. We're good here.
Somebody decided I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, with you. Can we move to the Justin slide? The clip number 3. I want to take another look at your movie.
Sure.
Kind of a trenchant scene. Okay. There's, you know, a lot of complicated things in that. One thing I love about
your movie.
Some things going on. One thing I like about your film is that it does show that sort of culture war black people have with themselves about how to be.
Yeah.
Things that they deal with. And so this is the last question. So if you know, you all might want to think about questions you have for us. As we think about it, as we kind of throw this last question to you, or this thought. So that's complicated. And I think that's, to me, my experience as a professional black person is that we're living in the age of Obama. I don't even know what that means. That's a whole... Why aren't we living in the age of Aaron Aubrey, Captain? We're living in the age of Obama, but also in the age of Ferguson, right?
Sure. Right.
So it forces people, I think it's forcing people to think about racial progress or lack thereof and the complexities and contradictions about blackness and race. But my experience is that non-people of color just don't like to think about the complexities. The things you guys do, you know, demands people look at the complexity, which includes the reality that, as Martin Luther King says, we've come far, but we ain't where we need to be, mm-hmm. right? So how do you think this message of complexity is being received by, you know, the public, by people who see your movie, people who read your book, people that you talk to? Mm. Are people getting it?
I mean, for me, it was, you know, people of color would see the film, it was sort of the sigh of relief. It's like, finally, someone...
Black people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Someone has articulated the complexity of it. I think it's part of human nature to want to sort of distill problems down into the easiest solvable bits.
Certainly the American impulse. Them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We don't want to... It's a stretch to sort of see ourselves in people who don't look like us. I mean, I think that's a human condition thing. And I think that part of the issue that, you know, black folks have is that, like, yeah, it's not as easy as, you know, commercials and hip-hop and popular culture make it seem. It's not so clear-cut. It's not so black and white. And what I got from, what I thought was very interesting about, you know, white people that saw and enjoyed the film was that they were able to see themselves in these characters that looked nothing like them. And that was such a novel experience for them. You know, this idea that, like, they could see themselves in this complicated story of what it means to be human, what it means to sort of find your identity, and have no other way to relate to these characters. You know, they weren't black, they're not going to an all-white school. That's not their experience. But they were able to see themselves in those characters, which unfortunately is kind of rare in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, for a movie about the human condition to focus on people of color, a movie that strives to be complicated and ambiguous, that's not very common. And so for me, it was I got a lot of gratitude, frankly. Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, balked at it. Some people were challenged by it in a way that they weren't comfortable with, and you know, didn't say some nice things. But by and large,
on both sides, like black and white,
on both sides, yeah. I mean, you know. I think the point of satire is to hold the mirror up. I like movies that leave me feeling some type of way about what I just saw.
Sure.
And leave me asking questions about myself that I didn't come into that experience having.
Right.
And so, you know, not everyone wants that in a movie. Some people want to be placated and patted on the head and sent out the door, but
some people,
I didn't make that movie.
And some, you know, I've experienced this. Some black people especially want positive images.
Yeah.
Because we are so inundated with the... And there's that binary of positive and negative, which goes back hundreds of years.
I mean, we've been
the image wars.
The forever,
image,
yeah.
We're always having to fight these horrible images, and so that continues.
Struggle. Yeah, it's a struggle. Do I fight the image,
or do I
tell the truth? You know, it's like, it's the air the dirty laundry thing. It's like, you know, we've been talking about this since the Harlem Renaissance. Spike Lee got in trouble with school. It's like, this is not a new thing, but for me as an artist, like, I don't make propaganda. I don't. I'm not selling something. I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm trying to hold a mirror up. And that means that everybody gets to be put on blast in my movie. I mean,
that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
But
that's
the other part of it too is I like what you said about the possibility of empathy being created, right? Mm-hmm. For the characters on the screen who might have different kinds of backgrounds or different kinds of lives than the folks who are watching. I mean, I feel like that's the value in art and creativity in that mm-hmm. respect, is being able to bridge that gap. I mean, I'm just full of King quotes right now, but King said something
okay.
like, he said something like, you know, people hate each other because they fear each other, and they fear each other because they're separated. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, the main thing that we have now is we have resegregation going on.
Mm-hmm. Been going on.
Mm-hmm. Ferguson is a resegregated suburb. It used to be, like, pretty damn near a sundown town.
That would be like a lot of places in Southern California.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, in the Bay Area as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that we haven't grappled with the fact that we've let resegregation occur. I mean, the peak of desegregation in terms of schooling came... actually, ironically, in 1989, But that's because after 1989, the right started pushing back on desegregation orders for schools. Mm-hmm. And so what you have now are a lot of areas, and there's this amazing series that was done by Nicole Hannah-Jones and ProPublica that I recommend everybody read about resegregation in schools.
I read that.
Yeah, it's powerful, right?
It's powerful, yeah.
And it's a story that's not being told. So at the end of last year, there was a poll that came out that said that for the first time since actually 1992, race was actually in the top issues that Americans were most worried about.
Hmm. Worried about.
Worried about.
The Negro problem.
Well,
I'm just...
There you go.
Right? Yeah.
You know, in 1992, you know, 2014, the last time it was at those numbers before that was 1965. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are so completely off. In 1965, it was something like 40 or 50% of Americans thought that. In 1992, and now it's something like 12 or 13%. So we're nowhere near a consensus that there's a problem.
That there's even
a Negro problem that needs to be solved, right, in that regard.
There's a Mexican problem.
There's other problems. There's problems.
Right.
But folks are nowhere near to a consensus for racial justice. And that's what I kind of took away from this past weekend, looking at this back and forth happening between LBJ and MLK, right? Folks can't even imagine that kind of thing happening now. Although Obama met with the young activists who had started these campaigns.
Yeah, the Black Lives Matter.
Right. Mm-hmm. In December, we can't imagine that there'd be a bill to desegregate schools again. We can't imagine that there could be a bill to decriminalize youth, right? We can't imagine a bill that would, end segregation in housing or preserve neighborhoods from gentrification. Gentrification is actually just a small part of resegregation. Mm-hmm. It's the part that folks in the city see and the part that newspaper reporters in the city can report on. But where do all these folks go, right? They go to Sanford and they go to Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Right, they go to San Leandro or Vallejo. Right, those are the cities where the heavy policing is happening. It's the same kind of containment that you had going on. So I feel like that's the gap that we, as folks who write as artists, unfortunately have to bridge through works of art like this. Mm-hmm. Right, where folks can kind of leap through that gap and see where we need to go because we're not living together anymore.
I think people like it that way. Or they come to expect, you know, I'm not supposed to have any black people in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think many people think gentrification means it is a good thing. Mm. So it gets down to what we believe and what we want.
Right.
And I think on that unresolved note, we're going to have to stop because we are over time. But I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
For this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah. This is amazing.
We could really go all day we could go forever, like you said. And now we'll take some questions from the audience. And hopefully you have a question. I know comments are fine, but brief. We really are interested in you throwing questions to the panel, these two.
First one's right over here.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
First, I want to say wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on colorblindness or post-racialism and how it's not just a cultural product. Mm-hmm. I work and study race in the law, and the Supreme Court, you know, as you know, has been sort of one of the main propagators of colorblindness.
Absolutely.
And in fact has disciplined, you know, state governments, federal governments who are trying to use race to dislodge these entrenched patterns. And just today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on a case that may completely eviscerate the Fair Housing Act, which was passed just after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Wow.
So the one of the few times that the Supreme Court has upheld a use of race, like affirmative action policy, was when it benefited universities and corporations. So I think there's this really interesting sort of corporatizing of diversity and this very sort of milquetoast version of diversity when it benefits American capitalism. So I just think that's a really fascinating way in which colorblindness is being, you know, dispersed around in legal and cultural spaces.
Right, right. Well, like I said, diversity is not justice. They're not the same thing at all. And I think colorblindness, you know, non-people of color are the ones who want to be colorblind. So it's all about who's dictating the terms and why. I think what it does is, like, it's like Justin said, it just kind of erases the problem in most in people's minds. It goes away, you know, like that. So you can give it all the intellectual arguments you want, but I think that's what's going on. People just don't want to think about it anymore. They just don't want to think about it anymore. It's too complicated. You guys have any response to that? The idea of colorblindness?
I mean, yeah, I mean, you said it. It's sort of, if I pretend that there's not a problem anymore, then the problem goes away, but all it does is just silence the people that are actually having the problem, and it's a shame because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a shame because we shouldn't have to sort of, just because there is a victory in one sector of the culture, you know, that can't mean that we have to stop in all the other areas that still need to keep moving. You know, mm-hmm. this idea that because one black man rose to be president, all the
he
other
just got a good job. That's all.
All the other problems facing all other black yeah. people are suddenly off the agenda. You know.
Well, you knew that was, and black people knew that was coming too. They said, "Oh no, he's president. Oh great. Oh no, they're gonna think it's all over."
Yeah.
And we were right.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he's an example, Obama's example of the 60s, post-60s generation that got through the, sort of the window, that did do well for themselves, but it was a fairly small group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just...
Yeah, the other thing I'd say is that colorblindness kind of gets reproduced every generation, mm-hmm. right? So, so that during the 80s, it gets reproduced again as a way of saying, like, equal opportunity is about equal opportunity for all. And so suddenly we now have ballot initiatives that are called civil rights initiatives that are about eliminating affirmative action. So in every generation, it gets recreated on sort of a personal level, as well as this level that you're talking about.
The legal level.
The legal level.
Yeah.
What we're seeing now, though, is really this long line of rollbacks, right? Of which the VRA rollback last year the Voting Rights Act rollback was a huge thing. And that's why I think Selma, the movie coming out right now, is so important, because it says, it emphasizes the importance of the Voting Rights Act in ways that a million editorialists could not.
Right.
Right.
And you know, it's impossible, again, to kind of see at this particular point how the politics could shift. But if artists are continuing to keep the imagination for change alive, then we might have a surge at some point, you know, where these laws become possible to be passed.
Just want to add one more thing to what you said, and that is the colorblind. And Randall Kennedy wrote a whole book about colorblindness and kind of exposed the myth of it. But up until very recently, you know, all American laws were about separating by color. It was the opposite of colorblind. It was very color conscious. And the reality is that we're very, 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 very color conscious. That's written into our laws. And to suddenly say, we're just colorblind now, is what psychologists might call reaction formation. It's just the same thing said a different way.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm okay.
Next question.
Yes, I teach at an institution where one third of the students are of Asian descent. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I go down to Monterey Park, where it's predominantly Asian, there's a sense of discomfort that I feel as if I go into a different other, you know, where it's predominantly white. So I was just wondering. And I also use the Fung Brothers. I don't know if you're familiar with their videos where they make fun of stereotypes against Asians. So,
huh.
Okay.
I haven't seen that.
So you're saying you're treated with suspicion? Or are you talking about?
No, just that the whole idea of race is very complex.
And, you know, how I feel as a black person when I'm in an Asian community, it's no one says anything, but
they look at you funny? What do you mean? I mean,
it's not funny. It's just a reality.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, these are the complexities of where we're at now, right? One of the things that really struck me was the end of the movie when you're running credits, because you have these images that you throw of actual crazy frat parties.
Blackface parties.
Blackface parties that folks
just like the movie.
Uh-huh.
Dartmouth, Florida, where you had one of the women blacked out there. I think she might have even been Asian or Latina or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. UC She's San Diego. Asian. But, you know, two of the biggest recent black student protests have come as a result of Asian Americans being foul like that. And I'm just going to put it out there. For those of us who are Asian American in the audience, we can all feel really gross about this right now, really uncomfortable. But I have to put it out there. At UC Irvine, there was a video that was done from an Asian American fraternity.
That's right.
In which
right.
they were doing a reenactment of Suit and Tie. And so they all kind of came out dressed up in tuxedos and that kind of thing, emulating Justin Timberlake. And then during the Jay-Z rap, the kid came out in blackface.
Yeah.
And this caused a huge stir amongst Asian Americans as well as African Americans on campus who were like, that's all about anti-blackness right there. And that caused basically 2 or 3 years now, I suppose, of these very deep kinds of conversations about the place of Asian Americans in relationship to African Americans and in relationship to race.
The model minority.
But even worse than that, I'm just going to state it plain. It's like you're showing that you're, and this is UC Irvine, which is like the hotbed of interactions between African Americans and Asian Americans. This is where Asian Americans begin starting stepping contests. This is the reason that Asian Americans dominated the ABDC show, America's Best Dance Crew, is because of all the folks coming from Irvine.
Because of UC Irvine.
Really?
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
All of this kind of interaction was happening during the 90s between African Americans and Asian Americans around dance, around hip hop dance.
Amazing.
We teach everybody how to dance.
So there was that. And then the following year at University of Michigan, there was a fraternity party in a historically white fraternity that whose staff, actually the president, the vice president, or whatever, the staff was Asian American. That was supposed to be a ratchet party, right?
What do you think that is? What is that?
And, well, okay, so I'm going to get to this. But what happened was that began the movement at University of Michigan called hashtag BBUM, being black at University of Michigan, which forced the regents of the University of Michigan to enter into discussions about how to address these questions of campus climate again, right? Campus climate at the University of Michigan. It was a huge thing. It led to the I2M Harvard campaigns. All kinds of stuff are kind of coming out of that. UCLA, the 33 video about the 33 student, the fact that UCLA Law School only has 33 African-American students, on and on and on.
Right.
But it's literally like Asian Americans can be down with blackness until they can get with whiteness, right?
Shit.
And that's what you could see happening in these videos.
Yeah.
And so it's a very complicated situation. And I think that
also
luckily
for Iggy Azalea.
Right.
Oh, we're not going to talk about
Iggy. Let's not talk about Iggy Azalea.
It's forbidden? Okay.
It's forbidden. Well, we can talk about it later. But no, it's not forbidden.
We're just
because we could go on for it.
We don't have time to talk about
it. Yeah, I feel like
let's go out afterwards and talk about Iggy Azalea.
But you know, the way you talk, it reminds me of something. I think Dick Gregory, the comedian, the activist Dick Gregory, said, everybody in America gets a chance to be a Negro except the Negro.
Mm.
So, you know, people, because we're sort of at the...
Because we don't have a choice.
We don't have a choice.
We can't step in it and out of it.
Right. There's just a history of degradation that nobody else has that allows people to sort of dip in and then move out.
Yeah.
Because there's nowhere to go but out and up from blackness. But historically.
But I just want to finish just by saying really quick. Yeah. Really recently, people have been calling Bill O'Reilly on white privilege. I think Jon Stewart had this big conversation with Bill O'Reilly about white privilege. He's all like, well, if you're going to talk about white privilege, then you should be talking about Asian privilege too. And that's where I think a lot of Asian Americans were like, oh, so that's how it really is.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, we've been the model minority. We've been like sort of like the recipients of your racist love all of this time.
Yeah.
But that's how you really feel about us. Like, when you start getting put under pressure, then you're going to say, oh, don't blame us. Blame them.
Yeah.
That's how it is. So I think that was, they're doing a service right now, actually, around this.
Thanks, Bill O'Reilly.
Thank you.
Final question, okay.
I wanted to know your thoughts on why high-profile leadership hasn't resulted in addressing these systematic racial problems. Specifically, Justin, say for example, you're a filmmaker, so there's a lot of concern now that there were not a lot of African Americans nominated for Academy Awards, yet the president of the Academy is a black woman. Mm-hmm. Jeff, you alluded to Martin Luther King's quote regarding the one thing he wanted was an end to police brutality. Mm-hmm. At that time, he was probably appealing to Robert Kennedy as the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Now the Attorney General of the United States is a black man. Right. The president is a black man. Right. And so these high-profile leaders in positions that we used to appeal to still haven't changed the things that people are looking to be changed. So I want to know your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think it goes back to what you were saying, Jeff. It's just this idea of multiculturalism as a kind of surface thing. You know, it's great that the president of the United States is black. It's great that the president of the Academy is black. But that doesn't change the fact that the voting members are not, by and large, and didn't see those films. And there's no sort of like, you know, urgency to sort of making that a priority. You know, the system is still the same. Just because the person on the top, the face of it looks different, the system was not changed, the system was not addressed, there was obviously not important enough to the people who actually make up the system to make a change.
Yeah, but that's what gets really confusing about now. It's like, you think that the fact that Obama's president, that has to mean something. But what it means is that he's a great individual success. It is not, he's not an expression of a movement of justice. He just did well for himself. Same with Eric Holder, too. I mean, so, and you know, there are a few that get through. And so, but it's very hard not to look at that, for the world to look at that and say, this has to be some proof of equality, but it isn't. So it's yet another complex thing Americans don't want to really look at. They just figure that, you know, if he did it, then obviously all of you all can do it, mm-hmm. right? But that's not the case. It was, you know, we've had high-profile black people a long time. We had Oprah, and you can put them all in the phone booth, right? Oprah, who's it? Tiger Woods. I mean, there's like, when you think about it, there's not that many, right?
And not if that all, many phone booths either, actually.
No phone booths anymore. Forget the phone booth. So it's just another
It just reinforces your point, actually. So.
Right, yeah. Right. And so just another complicated thing that
yeah, I mean, the truth
that kind of obscures the truth.
And I'll speak to just, you know, the Oscar thing, because that's yeah, sort sure. of more in my
Please.
Wheelhouse,
yes.
I think, than anything else. But just the fact is that, you know, the way the Academy Awards work is that there are voting members in this academy, and those members are people who are working industry people who are essentially go through a campaign to be inducted. It's this whole, and there's no voice for people of color in there. I mean it's systemic. There's not enough people of color working behind the camera. That's the first problem. There's not really an interest in finding ways to get our stories told and marketed to the masses and cultivate audiences. That's the other piece. And then those of us that have done that, there's really not an emphasis to make us voting members in the academy. So these are all the things. I mean, that's how an academy, you know, that's how a movie gets nominated. That's how a movie wins. And there's all of these other steps that have to happen. You know, it's not, you know, she's a wonderful person, and it's great that there's a black leader, but what about the members? What about the stories? What about the culture of Hollywood? That has to change.
Right.
And I think that's just a microcosm of what has to happen in the U.S. in general, right? I mean, we're all kind of rushing headlong towards 2042, right? And
we are.
So the question, well, demographically we are.
Oh, demographically,
There's no stopping that train. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, if we are going to all be minorities, then how do we form that new majority mm-hmm. is the question that comes up over and over again. And that's why the Voting Rights Act stuff is so important, because they're looking at the numbers. The other side's looking at the numbers and they're going, this is a train that's not going to stop. Mm-hmm. And so what's the best way that we can stop this in its tracks? Well, let's go after voting rights again, right? And that's, I think...
Disempowerment.
Mm-hmm. Structural, numeric, like just blatant, open, explicit disenfranchisement right. is what we're talking about here. And that's why it's so important for us to be thinking about, I think, trying to figure out how we build this new majority that's about a racial justice consensus. That's, I think, our the biggest issue that's going to face us over the next 50 years, along with the environmental crisis.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Whew. Okay.
Next
thank
time.
You, yeah.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.